Senate Judiciary Committee, June 21st, 1991, 1 p.m.
Committee will come to order.
Where's Senator Cameron?
She's going to be here, too. You want to be here first as a white
lady. Where's Greg? He was here.
He talked to me and said he wasn't going to be here.
He doesn't need to talk to you in public. He doesn't need to talk to me in private. Come on up, Fred. We are here, committee members, on a schedule for a number of people who are here for executive appointments from the governor. And then we have a few bills that are, I think, fairly straightforward that have been sent to us by the Senate president. I think most of them on yesterday. They are bills that in some ways relate to ways and means issues, some ways not. But for now, let's have Fred Purse, who has been and is up for reappointment, and to the Director of Department of Corrections. Fred, how are you doing?
Doing okay. Madam Chair, Fred Purse, Director of Corrections, for the record. I think things are going well in the department. We've certainly spent, I've been here now about 2 years and nearly 4 months, and it's been a certainly interesting 2 years and 4 months for me. I think the agency has really moved forward. We've had the opportunity to appoint about 85% of all the top managers since I've taken office, and I think we have it going in the right direction. And I'm committed to continue that process for a period of time.
Good. Well, when Fred, or somewhere during early part of Fred's tenure, he spent a lot of his time with the Interim Judiciary Committee under some very hard times. And I guess before anybody else asks any questions, I just want to say I appreciate Fred's willingness to cope with the legislative process throughout all that. And in fact, I'm pleased that you're willing to be back here and continue the job that you started, and that we sort of, I like to think, at least cleared the air so that you could get on with what the business really needed to be done over there in terms of straightening up the inside management. So with that, there are the questions from committee members. Fred.
I'm curious. Fred, and this is something that literally came up just a little while ago. I got a call, I think, from Eugene concerning the children of Diane Downs. What is the situation with, is there something about her being transferred to New Jersey or something like that, or there is a problem?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, she's here. She's been moved back from New Jersey, where we had her housed, for a post-conviction relief hearing. And she'll be here for whatever period of time that hearing goes on. She is in segregation in the Women's Correctional Center. She has attempted twice to escape from New Jersey, one fairly recently and one shortly after she got there. She will be kept in secure section of the prison while she's here. And I committed to some months ago that she would be returned to an out-of-state facility when the hearing was over. I again made that commitment this morning. I talked with Senator Gretchen Kearns a few moments ago and explained to him as well what the situation was. I'm not prepared to say where we'll transfer to, but it'll be for security reasons and security reasons only.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Hill.
Yes, sir. What do you, give me, do a little crystal balling for me now. What do you see for the future? We've had some problems concerning ballot measure 5 and so forth. What direction do you see us heading in the next 5 years or
boy.
So?
Boy. Madam Chair, Senator Hill, that does take a crystal ball, obviously. We are seeing a leveling off of the prison population here and in some other states as well. Whether that continues, I think, is a question we have to continue to look at and see what we're doing. There's been a considerable reduction in the criminal case filings at the felony level in various counties and overall in the state of Oregon. I don't have a lot of answers of why that is occurring, but I think that that we may have built the last male prison for a while. I would like to make the point to this committee and to the legislature in general that we have to do something about a new women's prison, and we have to do that hopefully by the next legislative session in some manner, shape, or form. We do not have sufficient room in our facilities to adequately manage our female population, and so that's an issue that's going to have to be dealt with. But as far as the male population, I think that perhaps for another one or two sessions there won't be a need to expand any further, and depending on what the population is doing at that time, it may remain stable for a while. As far as Measure 5, I don't know. You know, if there is no replacement revenue and we get hit next session with what's anticipated and the economy of the state hasn't risen enough to accommodate that, I suspect we'll be like many other agencies that we'll be looking at having to close some prisons or close one or more prisons. That's certainly what, as an agency, we're looking at in the light of a preparation for a potential no change for the next legislative session, and I know that all the agencies have been directed to begin looking at that and not wait until the end of the budget cycle a year from now and a year and a half from now and come up with some answers. So I don't know, Senator, what will come from that. I think sentencing guidelines have had an impact. I think that some other things have, perhaps a reduction in the number of drug offenses that have been prosecuted recently. There may be some settling out of all this drug issue. Seems to be in other areas
don't
of the country as well.
Don't you think that ultimately we're supposed to be making some headway with all this money we're throwing in there in terms of either education or whatever? I mean, it would seem to me that we would expect to have some decrease, for goodness sakes. Otherwise, we're throwing money away unnecessarily.
Madam Chair, I agree, and several years ago I was appointed to the White House Conference for a Drug-Free America. And we worked on that at that time. At that time, everything was still climbing, including all the studies of youth as well. And in the last 2 years, we've begun seeing a decline in those youth in middle school and high school who annually are studied to see how much drug use there is. And it is beginning to decline. So perhaps we are getting through the educational process in our schools around the country, making some headway to decline to improve that decline of daily, weekly, or monthly use of narcotics by our school children. Obviously, that's what's going to make change. We're not going to change it by arresting more people. I think you have to do that, but I think in time it's going to have to be that the people that are willing to say no, starting from kindergarten on up, and I think we're getting there. I really do. It's slow, and I think it'll be another generation, but I think it will, in fact, occur.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hamby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Fred, just a few days ago, we had a conference committee hear about an issue that that passed the Senate, of course, and the House had some problems understanding the basic problem that we're attempting to address from this chamber. The management people that you sent over, of course, were not members of the Corrections Department in 1983 when, in a rather unprecedented move, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing at the Women's Correctional Center. Because we had heard via the mail, several legislators had been alerted to what we felt was perhaps mistreatment. The issue focused on a contract and position, and rather than go into it, the concern that we had here just a few days ago was that under your administration, rules have tightened now, that in an outgoing mail can be opened and checked without the inmate's presence, and oftentimes a decision that perhaps the outgoing mail not be mailed unless mail is clearly marked on the outside legal mail. And we certainly understand all the problems with forging stationery, et cetera, from attorneys and such. The rules, of course, that were recommended by your management people were recommended simply as rules and not as anything that we might look to in statutes. There are very few of us that are still left here from 1983, Springer and Cohn and myself, I think. We were able to turn it around in 83, but it apparently seems far more difficult today. Do you have a response to it?
Madam Chair, Senator Hanby, the issue on mail is a very serious issue with us, and we have recently done some training with our mailroom staff so that we would have a consistent policy, or our policy will be consistently carried out. I just reviewed a few minutes before coming in here. I just returned to town last night. I reviewed the proposed rules. I happen to believe that we ought to do it by rule and not by statute. But and we have revised some rules that would deal with official mail that I think would accommodate your concerns that would be different from legal mail. And currently our rules cover legal mail. That would provide for, I believe, what you want to see. It's really critical that the manipulation by inmates of the mail system, and quite frankly by some folks outside the mail system, even in the legal profession, have been a problem from time to time in prisons. And so it's important that we continue to maintain control to the degree it's required to keep the institution safe and secure. But I suspect that and hope that you will be satisfied with the rule that the Attorney General has proposed, or has modified with my Inspector General, that will provide for official mail going to legislators, as well as others, but certainly with legislators, will only be opened in the presence of the inmate, unless a very serious ongoing investigation is going on with that inmate, and then we would not do that, and we would so note that. But
Fred, we're well aware of manipulation, the ease of manipulation on both sides of the issue, but I think you recognize our concern of the importance it is for us at least to be aware if there might be a potential problem in any institutions.
Certainly. Senator Hanby, and I'm committed to make that work. This agency has been an interesting one to try to change and make the way we deal in each institution consistent, but we're making it. It's happening. And mail is one of those issues that we've been working on in recent months, as a matter of fact, so that it is consistently dealt with and that there is proper notice when we do something that with a person's mail.
Thank you.
Yeah, there are further questions from committee members? Then the chair would move that we recommend reappointment of Fred Person, urge him to go forward. A concern, I guess I do have a question, Fred, as long as I have you here. We've had a lot of discussions about Inspector Generals versus Ombudsperson, and now we don't have an Ombuds. We will be phasing out, I guess, best I know, the Ombudsperson. What plans do you have as an agency to try to facilitate some of the duties that sort of assist with handling real and perceived problems within the institutions that the ombudsman had a role to play in. Tell me a little bit about your general versus ombudsman and how you're going to handle those things now.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to respond to that. It's an issue that comes up often and has been, and certainly in this session, particularly with the apparent elimination of the funding for the ombudsman. I personally am convinced that that we can be responsive to the staff and the inmates through the Inspector General's office. I think that there's been certainly a learning curve on the part of the staff of the Inspector General's office. We did bring all of the internal affairs investigators from outside the agency into the Inspector General's office. So we didn't, with the exception of one who was the former and continues to be one of our internal affairs officers, I brought them all in from other agencies. You don't change perceptions overnight. I think you have to prove yourself that you in fact are independent and do in fact are willing to look and investigate what is brought to you and not just decide in advance that there is no need to do that, or for some reason you want to hide something. That is not done in the Inspector General's office. I'm not going to sit here and try to convince you that everybody in the agency, both as staff and certainly all of the inmates that in public, that they're going to instantly believe that. I think that would be naive of me and naive of you to believe it if I said it. But I think through our efforts and being able to show that, in fact, we do look into these things, we do investigate them, we do carry out and be responsive to both the public staff and the inmates when they make a complaint, that we will show that, in fact, that we are able to do the kinds of investigations that are necessary to keep the agency free of fraud and corruption. And with that, I'm not sure how else I could convince anyone. I think we're just going to have to show you that in fact, can happen and will happen.
Well, I guess then I just want to let you know that while we're not likely to embark on the kind of activities we embarked on during last interim, I think the committee will be looking very carefully and listening very carefully, most importantly, I guess that's the word I'd like to get out, and I know Senator Hill would second that, given what we've been through on all of that. That we're going to be observing very carefully how the Inspector General is doing, what kind of complaints we get through the underground from seeing how you, and appreciate your willingness to take a hold of this. Okay, with that, I would move that we approve Fred Peirce for his reappointment. Are there any objections to that? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you, Fred.
Thank you. All of you.
Okay, is Stephen Scheer here? Come on up, please. Oh. So Dr. Scheer is here as a appointment to the Psychiatric Security Review Board, and I guess since you are a new appointment, we'd like to hear a little bit about how you see yourself filling the role and what kinds of things you'd like to bring to that board in terms of the kind of clients that they oversee. So we'll just need your name for the record first, thanks.
It's Dr. Stephen Scheer. And I'm the person who will be filling, if you approve, the psychologist position on the Psychiatric Security Review Board. And as you know, the mission of the review board is essentially to protect the community and to make sure there's adequate information to make judgments about whether those who have been found guilty but not convicted because of insanity, whether or not they are ready to be in the community, and to understand the circumstances by which they'd be released, make sure we have enough information to make those decisions, to make decisions about whether they'd be hospitalized or in the community. So I certainly take this very seriously. It's been an interest of mine since graduate school, when I worked with a psychologist who's done research in this country and internationally on the insanity plea and dealing with those who are judged insane and not guilty or not convicted because of that. Be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Madam Chair, may I, ready for a motion?
You could. I guess I do want to examine, alert him to the pressures that we always see here from that board consistently has been asked to take in over clients that are not necessary, that are misdemeanor type clients, that are personality disorders. And there's been a struggle to keep a load there on that board that's manageable. Mm-hmm. And I guess I would urge you to be alert to those kinds of considerations in terms of workload so that you don't diminish the effectiveness of the board. We as a legislature will continually press to add more types of clients to the board. I would be one of those who would ask you to consider very carefully about that and to advise us directly and specifically what you think is appropriate.
Yes, well, Madam Chair, I'm certainly one who will not keep quiet if I feel that the board has more work than they can do in not only an adequate way, but in a way that they can make good, solid judgments about people. And I think that's critical, and that's one of the reasons that this board and the method with which we deal with those who are judged guilty but not convicted, one of the reasons it's working well in this state is that there is adequate supervision and there is excellent modes of communication between the board and those who are monitoring the people in the community. And there has not been an overload. And that's one of the reasons it's one of the best in the country, and it's seen as one of the best in the country, in the literature. So one of my aims is to keep it that way and keep it on top and keep moving forward.
Good. Thank you.
I'll check that before Senator Shoemaker makes the motion. There was obviously a reason that you like this kind of a challenge in this position. Could you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Well, in a way, for me, it's a public service. I enjoy the work that I do. I work a lot with individuals in doing psychotherapy and seeing them get healthy. I feel like part of my job as a psychologist is an obligation to the community, and I've had a history in working in this area, both from the time I was in graduate school and before when I was a VISTA volunteer working in the prison. And so I've worked with people who have had these difficulties, and I've worked with systems before. I think I can do it well. And that's essentially the reason. I've had a particular interest also because the chairman of my graduate program was involved in this area of work, and I got interested early on in it.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you very much. Then, if there are no further questions, I'd accept a motion from... you have another question, Senator Hamby?
Just a comment.
Sure.
Just from, as one member of this committee, I'm not familiar with the... academic philosophy of the University of Wyoming, and I apologize for that. But a number of us on the committee would really like to see an evaluation or a report or some more suggestions as to how we might perhaps improve some of our treatment and therapy programs. So it will be interesting in your experience to get some feedback on it.
Madam Chairman and Senator Hamby, I'd be happy after some time and experience on the board to give you feedback about information that we receive on the board about the quality of the treatment programs and the treatment programs not only in the institutions but in the community, which is one reason that this program has been reasonably successful, is that they've planned for the treatment and the coordination and supervision in the community before people are released.
Thank you.
Thank you. Then I would accept Senator Shoemaker's motion.
All right.
Any questions, Bob?
I will then move that we recommend the approval of the appointment of Stephen Scherr to the Psychiatric Security Review Board.
Thank you. Are there objections to Senator Shoemaker's motion? Hearing none, so ordered. Thanks very much for coming. Appreciate it. And look forward to hearing from you later on. Okay, we have an appointment to the Parole and Post-Prison Supervision Board, Laverness Coleman. Welcome. It'll be a little bit. You've had a chance to sort of hear the routine here. We do need your name officially for the record, and then some would be helpful to have some comments about why you're interested in serving and what you would be interested in contributing to the board.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lee Coleman. I'm currently the director of the Regulatory Process Division of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I am interested in being a member of the Board of Parole because I, first and foremost, really enjoy and believe in state government in Oregon. I see it as a very innovative government with some very energetic people who serve the citizens of Oregon well. I think by becoming a member of the parole board, I can bring my background and experience as a regulator with the Liquor Commission, as a lawyer, and as someone who's not been intimately involved with the criminal justice system. I think perhaps a little different perspective to the board, and I think that that perspective would help me contribute to the Board of Parole as a vital member on that board.
Further comments and questions?
I have one, Madam Chair.
Senator Hill.
Yes, Ms. Coleman, do you have any notions about how people of color are treated in our criminal justice system?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Hill, I believe that there are a disproportionate number of ethnic people in the criminal justice system for a variety of reasons having to do with issues ranging from employment to drug abuse, to poverty. I believe that is the case. I believe once people enter the criminal justice system, however, that they are to be treated equally as inmates. And all of the guidelines that apply to one inmate should, I believe, apply to all, depending on their individual circumstances, certainly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The role of the parole board and post-supervision board is now really just embarking on major review and revision and redirection, at least from the way we understand it. And much more in the future will be involved in a little bit of what you heard from, the psychiatric review board person, that much more involved in placement and community evaluation of programs, trying to anticipate what kinds of community facilities and programs are suitable for the inmates as they leave the institution. So how do you, I guess I just need a comment or two from you if you can conceptualize your commitment to that and how you might yourself respond to that new charge, which I think is going to have to bring a different set of both resources and recommendations from the parole board, both ultimately maybe from you to the legislature next session about what you think needs to be happening out there to help you fulfill your job.
Right. Madam Chair, while I'm not familiar in great detail with a lot of the changes on the horizon, I have had some discussion with Chairman Fotz about some of the changes that the board will be undergoing. I think because of the changes anticipated, getting more involved in local communities and how they handle parolees, I think this is an exciting time to be coming on to the board. I'm very stimulated by the prospects of being more involved in community-type solutions for our prison populations. So I'm looking forward to that. As far as my contribution, I really don't know that I can give you a lot of detail, except that I'm energized about the prospect of being involved in a change, in a major change in the system. And I think that it'll require a lot of hard work and dedication on the part of all the board members to see this accomplished.
So it's clear that this is an important piece of legislation. I just have one question. And it is because I haven't had a chance to kind of take a look at it. Somewhere in the it's the other bills that deal with the reduction in sentence. I wonder how you got to that. It's not this one.
Right.
It is in here too. How do you manage to do that within the sentencing guidelines, which say you can only have certain good? Does this come under the kind of if you participate in this, you get automatic good, say points toward good behavior? Is that how you work?
This simply qualifies this program. It qualifies participation as one of the factors that can be considered in that 20% band on the sentencing guidelines. Yeah, not required.
That's what I wondered how you could get beyond the 20 and whether this was an add-on.
No.
Obviously, it is not. It is
one of the ways they can earn the 20%. For example, if you have to participate, but you know, as they're required to, but they don't make any effort, they make no progress, they don't pass, they don't achieve literacy and don't care and don't try, it's unlikely they're going to get very many points for that.
Thanks very much. The question, Senator
Schumer. On that point, in reading the bill in that regard, I wonder if a technical amendment is appropriate. Section 5, which deals with the reduction in sentence for participation in the program, seems to distinguish appropriate institutional behavior from participation in the functional literacy program as two different things. If I read it correctly, then the next line says the maximum amount of time credits earned for appropriate institutional behavior shall not exceed 20%. I wonder if we should properly add to that the maximum earned for appropriate institutional behavior and for participation in the functional literacy program.
Or,
you're right. Whether that wouldn't make it clear that 20% applies to both those programs.
Madam Chair, I would say that if the committee views that that's a problem enough. I get worried about timelines, but if it's a problem that someone could challenge later or something like that, then we need to do what's right with the bill.
Well, I guess I'd.
Ewood, what do you say after reading that? I just took a very quick glance at it, which provoked my question, and not in as detail as Senator Shoemaker is now.
Well, I just
laid it out for us, but.
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, technically I think you could read it to give additional credit beyond the 20% for the functional literacy program.
It sure looks that way to me.
Yeah, Madam Chair, in which case I would move to amend line 21 on page 3 to add after the words appropriate institutional behavior words or for participation in the functional literacy program described in ORS 421.084.
So you're just repeating that word in a sense?
Reading the phrase.
Yeah.
Okay, are there objections to that motion? And we'll check with legislative council and find out to make sure that we do need to put it, we'll adopt it in a concept form right now, and if it's not needed, clearly by legislative council, we'll just jettison, and the committee will understand that. That this
really
is,
not trying to get away with the bill.
That this good is bill. A conceptual amendment, and however legislative council needs to review it and to fit it in. Here, are there objections to Senator Shoemaker's motion? Hearing none, so on. Thank you. And I would then say that if you keep a little tab on this and urge concurrence when you get to the House.
I will be doing that, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Without going to another conference committee.
Yes. So if you could do that, please, Representative Bryan, we would we'd ask you to help us facilitate that we're not.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I must share with the committee and with Tom here. Looking back at these old statutes, I was an educator with Northwest Regional Educational Labs at the time. The reference to the old study and recommendations. But in those days, I swear they had a director, but I know they did, of education.
Madam Chair, it's come and gone. It hasn't been statutory.
Yeah.
And so the interest in education, I guess, for a variety of reasons, philosophy or resources, has come and gone. We went back to the old libraries and found studies and reports from 1974, 1978, all recommending we get our act together and get a plan, and we never have.
Well, we thank you for your work. I mean, it's not been, this kind of an effort is not an easy one.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Appreciate finally bringing it to closure for us. Thanks for
Ryan
a lot. Okay, the bill already.
Okay, Madam Chair, then I move House Bill 3437 as amended to the floor.
Thank you. Senator Hill moves House Bill 3437 to the floor as amended.
Madam Chair, and that's with a letter requesting the rescission of the referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you. Are there objections to Senator Hill's motion? All right. We've got to call the roll, please. Thanks.
Senator Benn.
Aye.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay. Now let's see if we can get Bob Olson up on House Bill 3455 quickly before we get into some of the.
Madam Chair, Bob Olson, Oregon State Bar. This bill is another example of the, the legal profession staying caught up on technology. It's a small but worthwhile change. Duplicate copies would now be included as facsimile reproductions or as faxes when they're on the right kind of paper.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hamby.
Bob, the newest machines have just plain old white stationery, and they're no longer using non-thermal.
Well, there are still some of those in existence, and that I think it was Mr. Shepard's amendment to make clear that nobody would be using the kind of paper that would tend to fade or disintegrate, and maybe Mr. Shepard liked the comment.
I'm Ross Shepard. I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Today I represent the district attorneys. Also, this was their bill. I did propose the amendment that the document be identified as a facsimile, and by that I mean for the legislative history, that the facsimile machine itself print on the document that it is a facsimile and the date and the time that it was received, and printed on non-thermal paper. I don't know if that's a technical term or not, thermal paper, but what I was trying to avoid is the thin, almost transparent sort of paper that a lot of fax machines use, because print tends to disappear on that kind of paper after 2 or 3 months. And if we admit this piece of paper as a piece of evidence, we don't want to have all of a sudden a blank piece of paper in the file. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there
questions? Well, I'm concerned that if the way it's phrased, that it would have to be printed on, quote, non-thermal paper in order to qualify as a duplicate. I don't think that's what you mean.
And
I'm concerned that this might serve as an unfortunate limitation.
Well, That's what I meant. The new machines.
There isn't a way to get at it that doesn't cause it to do that. Could we make some reference to the reproduction? Permanent is probably too strong a word, but somehow describe the reproduction in what we want it to achieve. That is, that it's a permanent or long-lasting reproduction. Something. So that we can...
If the committee has difficulty with that. What I had envisaged was if we have the standard old type of fax machine, it would come out, then we'd put that on and copy it onto regular bond paper.
Mm-hmm.
And the definition of duplicate, starting on line 6, would allow that. And we'd have then on good paper the identification that it came from a fax machine, the date and time. And I think that would fit within this language.
Senator, another possibility would just be to specify that old kind of paper, which is being used less and less. So you would say not printed on thermal paper if you wanted to. I'm not sure any of this is really necessary since there's so little of it being used anymore, which I think was Senator Hamby's point.
Right.
Well, I don't know, Madam Chair. I don't want to make a big issue of it.
My point, Madam Chair, in bringing it up,
yes, Senator Hamby.
The way I read it, the new machines would not be recognized as fax because they are, although they are identified as a facsimile, they are not on non-thermal paper. Do you follow me? It says and printed on, it's identified as a fax and printed on non-thermal paper. In other words, you don't recognize any of the new machines as being, the new fax machines as being duplicates. Did I make myself clear? That's what I read it as.
Well, the flimsy things are thermal paper.
Yeah.
The new machines are probably non-thermal paper anyway.
New machines
are non-thermal paper. They're regular paper.
They're bond.
Yeah.
Well, that would mean that they were non-thermal.
They're not.
Everything but the flimsy is non-thermal.
That's what I was trying to get to, but I don't have any expertise in this area, so.
Well, I guess we have a legislative record.
Yeah, we're making
a
record.
I think we do have a record.
Yes. Okay. I don't think we can amend it any further in that way, because a piece of bond would certainly qualify as a non-thermal piece of paper. It's an ordinary piece of paper that isn't. Yeah. Slippery, slimy. that I just throw away because they slip out of my files and sort of like plastic. I don't deal with them.
I think we have a wonderful record on this bill.
Thank you. Are there motions on this bill?
Move the bill.
Senator Springer moves House Bill 3455 to the floor unamended with a due pass recommendation. Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman.
Doesn't tell me anything.
Facsimiles can be used. Aye.
To.
Senator Benn.
Off. Oh, aye.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
I don't know. I guess so.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cowan.
Aye. Thank you. Motion passed.
That doesn't necessarily mean I did the right thing.
Well, we need to figure that out. Thank you. Excuse me. We have another little operation. House Bill 3520, Bill.
We have Mr. Lando and Charlie Williamson here. We have reached a tentative compromise in this bill. I'll compromise the subject of the approval of the committee.
Okay, thank you. Yes, the committee chair sort of suggested we had a try for at least something on this bill. It seemed overbroad. Been in touch with the Department of Justice, at least parts of it. And have some amendments. We have Dave Fidanke from ACLU. Why don't you come on up, Dave? David, and have you seen the amendments?
Yes.
Okay. So, Bill, whoever.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you like, I'm back. There's an engrossed version of the bill, Madam Chair, plus the A3 amendments. And what we do is basically leave in Section 1 of the bill with an addition down on line 13 of such to a qualifier. Remove on lines 26 the word decision to perform. At the top of the next page, remove the bold language starting in lines 1 through lines 5. And then removing Section 2 through 8. And the basic reason for this is that the particular language is after Section 2 and the language at the top of page 2. It's very broad, and at this late date in the session, it would be difficult to, for example, determine all the potential factors that could be involved in determining liability or whether we should absolve a public body from all liability set forth in Sections 2 and below. What that leaves is, it's still a substantial part of the bill. On Section 1, this is basically a provision that Mr. Landau from the Department of Justice tells me comes from the Federal Tort Claims Act, and it makes very clear that a state employee, or for that matter, a county or city employee, acting within the scope of their employment cannot be sued in their individual capacity, and if they are, that the matter would be dismissed. It also, what it does over in line 5 and 6 on page 2, makes it quite clear that the ultimate statute of repose applies to matters under the Tort Claims Act. And I understand that Mr. Landau, that there is a 1981 Court of Appeals case, O'Brien case, and 1986, excuse me, which the Court of Appeals held that the ultimate statute of repose did not necessarily apply to Tort Claims Acts, and that causes particular problems in medical malpractice cases arriving from Oregon Health Institute. So this would make it quite clear that, in fact, the ultimate statute of repose does apply under a tort claim action. I met with Mr. Landau and Mr. Williamson yesterday and this morning, and over this bill and worked out this arrangement.
Okay. Landau, since it's the Department of Justice bill, this is probably about the best we can do, but let's talk about what you think it still does for you and what you intended to do, and we'd like to hear hear your comments both on the bill and your original.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jack Landau, Deputy Attorney General. I think the summary fairly characterized what's left. What we have are two provisions. The first makes it clear that to the extent we have an individual state officer who is subject to indemnification by the state anyway, you can't sue that individual officer. So it doesn't change anything with respect to the bottom line for the plaintiff. The plaintiff's going to get paid just as much. The limitations on the amount that the plaintiff can get out of the state will not change. It simply takes the individual who was indemnified anyway out of the formula. The reasons for that are several, one of which is because they're indemnified anyway, it's of no consequence. A second is that there are adverse consequences to just being named in a lawsuit, whether or not you win or lose. OHSU doctors, for example, have complained to us that win or lose, their insurance premiums go up if they're just named in a lawsuit. I think perhaps some members of the legislature are familiar with the consequences of having lawsuits filed against them. Appears on your credit bureau report, win or lose, it causes problems. And when it doesn't affect the bottom line for the plaintiffs, we don't think there's any reason to have it in there. We also spend a lot of time, I know from personal experience, in handling things like the Measure 5 lawsuit, the school finance lawsuit. We spend a lot of time arguing over who are the proper parties to be named in a lawsuit. It's really a waste of the state's resources to fight over those kinds of things when it doesn't change the bottom line. As Bill said, this is patterned after the Federal Tort Claims Act, almost verbatim, and accomplishes just that. Where you have somebody already indemnified, they can't be sued. This does not affect the right of people to sue individual state officers if they're acting outside the scope of their employment. That is not affected. Okay. The second portion of this bill that is left simply makes clear what the Court of Appeals has told us is not clear, and that is that the statutes of ultimate repose do apply to the state of Oregon. Because of some peculiarities in the language of a 1981 bill in which the legislature established a general two-year statute of limitations for lawsuits against the state, the Court of Appeals just this last year said the statute of ultimate repose applies to everybody else in the universe except the state of Oregon. They acknowledge that this could be interpreted as a little screwy, but that appears to be what the legislature intended. If the legislature didn't intend it, it should change it. We are taking the court up on its invitation. I think it's a matter of common sense that the state should not be held liable ad infinitum. I mean, forever. Witnesses dead and buried, gone. 50 years later, somebody could bring a tort claim against the state. We should be entitled to the same statutes of ultimate repose that everybody else. That's really what's left of the bill. We think those are important. Although the bill is substantially shorter than it started out, this is, we think, a good compromise, and we appreciate the help of counsel and gentlemen on my left and right.
Okay, thank you. Charlie?
I think that Mr. Landau has accurately and Mr. Taylor have accurately said what we could say. It's our understanding that Section 1, Sub 1, the changes there will not affect anybody's constitutional right to challenge statutes or their treatment by the state in cases where you have to sue somebody individually, and that we're not granting immunity to anybody that the state is not responsible for. The rest of the bill that's deleted, there are things that could be talked about there, but they're very, very complicated and would require a lot of research and a lot of time to go into the parts of the bill that have been deleted, and we would hope that the committee would not want to take those up. It would be very difficult. Thank you.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. For the record, David Fidanke, ACLU of Oregon. I think the legislative record here is already clear. I just wanted to amplify on it a little bit more. It has been a concern of the ACLU for a number of years now that there is no statutory remedy under Oregon law for violations of people's state constitutional rights. That is something that we believe is that needs to be remedied at some point. But of course, there is such statutory relief under federal law for violations of the federal constitutional rights. Nevertheless, the Oregon Supreme Court on several occasions has recognized that there may be, in Oregon, the right to sue under the Constitution, an implied constitutional tort, for violations of some of the Oregon Bill of Rights provisions, in particular the section that has been singled out is Article 1, Section 9, the Search and Seizure Clause. They have never answered that question definitively one way or the other, and we just wanted to make absolutely sure, clear here today, that if there is a constitutional tort in Oregon, that this bill will not foreclose it. And it is our understanding that is the intent, that it is not the intent of the Department of Justice to foreclose such an action if it is available under the Oregon Constitution. And on that basis, we would support these amendments.
Thank you.
Would you like me to respond to that?
We might as well, as long as you're here. Okay. A minute or two, be fine.
Madam Chair, he's absolutely right. To the extent that the courts or the legislature create any new torts, that would not be affected by the legislation that you have before you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Are there, Chair would move that A3 amendments then? Those are the ones we're supposed to be moving. Correct, Bill?
That's correct.
Okay. Are there objections to the A3 amendments to House Bill 3520? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Senator Hanby moves House Bill 3520 as amended to the floor with a DuPess recommendation. Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Benn.
Aye.
Senator Hanby.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
No.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Okay, House Bill 3103. Another little hornet's nest has been delivered to us, unsuspecting, from Ways and Means. Uninvited from Ways and Means, I should say. I thought we were finished with hornet's nest, but here they come. Okay, this bill comes to us, I think, from Ways and Means. Is this correct, Ingrid?
That is, well, Madam Chair, on the House, let me see, it has a, I beg your pardon, I don't get the room here. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay.
And.
Subsequent came from
there. I thought it just came from there.
Yes.
Well, I think it might have.
Okay, let's.
Who's
do the
that?
Sign up sheets.
Yeah.
We have Dean Renfro, Major from the Oregon State Police. Come on up, please, Major Renfro.
Madam Chair, while Major's taking his seat, I'd like to publicly thank him for all the effort he helped us with this morning, drafting the minority and majority bill. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Hanby, thank
Renfro.
You very much. Well, Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Major Dean Renfro, Oregon State Police Criminal Investigation Division. I'm here in support of House Bill 3103, and as you've mentioned, it is a kind of a touchy subject, and I hope I can articulate to you the importance and the justification that we believe is so important to the bill. First of all, the bill deals with three issues. One is the juvenile fingerprints and photographs to include missing children and serious juvenile offenders. And the other is the incorporation of fees for the thumbprint, fingerprint checks on handgun purchases. First of all, the bill regarding fingerprinting children. Now that we have an AFIS system available to law enforcement agencies in the state, it's a technology that not all jurisdictions have and can certainly be very instrumental in solving crimes and help missing children be recovered, those that might be abducted or missing for a variety of reasons. We don't seek to change the law at all as to what criteria you have to go through to obtain fingerprints from juveniles or photographs. What we do seek is to use that technology in placing in the AFIS file, aside and very separate from the adult prints, those prints from about 1,500 serious juvenile offenders so that their prints can be compared to crime scene prints of major crimes that are occurring in Oregon. As you may be aware, many crimes are committed by juveniles.
Senator Bond has a question.
Yes.
You're talking about putting juvenile files in the AFIS system instead of keeping them separate as the law currently requires. But as you deal with those 1,500, aren't you also saying if my 12-year-old son has the sheriff's office come in and do the fingerprinting for identifying lost kids, that those can also be entered in the AFIS system?
Madam Chair, Senator DeBunn, only if the parent or guardian asked for that to be done.
Okay, but if the public affairs office for the sheriff's office comes by and does a presentation at school and says, we want to help find kids if they're lost, and we say, great, do that. So we give our consent. Then, giving our consent, thinking those are going to be used to help find kids. In fact, can't those be entered in APHIS and be used for criminal prosecutions, or simply, as the bill says, state police shall enter in an index in the computerized criminal history files the name of the child?
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, those prints that are taken for public relations purposes for in the event that children are missing, those prints are left with the parents.
Okay. The bill says, if I read it correctly, on page 2, line 2, fingerprint files or records may be submitted to the Department of the State Police Bureau of Criminal Identification, and it goes on. Is there anything that prohibits those prints from being turned over to APHIS? As I read the bill, it specifically allows that to happen.
I'll have to, Senator Bunn, I'll have to check into that, but it's the our intent that those prints that you've mentioned will retain with the parents. And only the bill does specify that those prints that we receive from a law enforcement agency that are in relation to a particular crime or investigation of a crime are entered into the APHIS system.
Okay.
And I will look into that.
Okay, because in particular, the bill in Section 1, Sub E, does state that if the child is less than 10 years of age, then no copies will be made of those and they will be returned to the parents. But for any child over 10 years of age, it doesn't address that. And so for the child over 10 years, the right to take those prints, once the parent consents, the use of those prints is the same as a child taken into the custody of the state. There's no distinction then for the use of those prints.
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, if the child is over 10 years of age, it also requires the child's permission as well as the...
Okay, but my point is, if we're going out getting fingerprints for the purpose of finding lost children, we do not limit the use of those fingerprints to lost children. We specifically allow those prints to be entered in APHIS, unless I read the bill incorrectly.
Okay, Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, I will check into that, but it's my understanding that it would take, in those situations that are non-criminal, the request from the parent or guardian.
Madam Chair,
yes,
and I just don't know how the APHIS system is set up, but when it talks about an